It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret. The new State of Working Wisconsin report is out for 2025. The annual report, released around Labor Day, tracks employment and wages in the Wisconsin economy. This year, the median wage for Wisconsin workers hit an all-time high at $25 per hour, and the state's total number of jobs hit a high as well, over 3 million. But beneath those numbers, the report authors point to inequality among different groups and regions of the state, challenges from federal policy, and some potential signs of an economic slowdown. Laura Dresser is a co-author of the report and associate director of the High Road Strategy Center. Laura, thanks a lot for joining us today.
It's great to be here.
Let's start with those numbers I just mentioned. Median wage, an all-time high, total number of jobs, an all-time high. Break that down for us. What does that mean?
Well, I think we've seen a really strong recovery from the pandemic shutdowns, and that strength has been year over year. We've seen wage increases that got knocked back by inflation in 2022. But when I'm talking about the highest wage, in fact, I'm talking about adjusting for inflation. So in 2023, in 2024, and that's the 2024 wage is the latest we can get. The wages kept moving up. And so now the median wage in the state is $25 an hour. It's been steady growth, except for that year that inflation took it out. It relates to the underlying growth of the job market. The strong economy has, put jobs, more and more jobs in the state, and it gives workers a stronger position to demand more of their work. And that's, I think, the dynamic that we've seen and has continued. But has continued up through the 24 data on wages and through the recent data on jobs in the state.
How does Wisconsin track compared to national trends?
You know, honestly, our growth is a little slow across the pandemic. Right now, the U.S. economy has 5% more jobs than it had before the lockdowns. And Wisconsin just has 2% more jobs than it did before the lockdown. So Wisconsin growth has lagged relative to the national growth in this recovery and in the previous one.
And when it comes to unemployment numbers, I've seen in the past Wisconsin tends to have lower unemployment than the national average. Is that still true?
That's still true. We have very low unemployment in the state right now. It's around 3%, hovering just above that. The tightest labor market we've ever seen was earlier in the pandemic recovery, down in the twos, but 3% unemployment is well below the national level, very low unemployment. It does mean that workers have more room to kind of either look for better work somewhere else or to talk to their employer about making work better where they are.
All right, if we stop with those two numbers, overall number of jobs and that median wage, things look pretty good. You don't stop there in that report. You point out that those overall numbers obscure some differences among different groups in the state by region, by race, by which sector of the economy. Where do you see problems underneath those numbers?
Underneath those numbers, we see there's a lot of inequality in this state. The High Road Strategy Center and others have long documented the extreme racial disparity between Black and white residents of the state, really higher levels than national levels, and that have that emerged across the 1980s and have been sustained till now. So really serious problems of Black and white inequality, though some of those gaps have closed slightly across this pandemic recovery, which I think is good news. Really significant geographic gaps. Unemployment is one way to see that, and unemployment is lower in Dane County and some counties in the south of Wisconsin, much higher further north. But actually, some of those gaps have come down across this. So yes, inequality and very substantial inequality by race, gender, ethnicity, but also some shrinkage in that, especially in general, not for every single group, but in general, some shrinkage of that inequality across this pandemic recovery.
Talking to Laura Dresser with the High Road Strategy Center, co-author of the new State of Working Wisconsin report for 2025. Laura, also in the report, you and your co-authors raise some red flags, warnings of a potential slowdown in Wisconsin's economy. What are those red flags?
Well, we've seen a real softening nationally and in Wisconsin in the kind of month-to-month job growth. So the jobs added in 2025 averaged just above 1,000 a month. That's growth. Yes, that's good. It gets you a new high, but that's not very strong growth. And at the national level, of course, the July jobs report showed such weakness in the national economy that analysts were really concerned about what that meant. The trajectory of the economy, that it looks a bit like an inflection point, it's slowing down. And that's true in the state. The Wisconsin economy does not avoid the national trends, and there's very serious concerns. And I think that looks back to the questions of the real hallmarks of the Trump administration, both the anti-immigration policies and the tariff policies, which are a drag on the economy. And I think that's where the concern for me and many, many analysts sit.
Let's get into tariffs now. A court ruling says President Trump didn't have the authority to do at least many of the tariffs. They're still in effect, though, as appeals are awaited. Wisconsin has a disproportionate manufacturing economy, I think, compared to the national average. Same for agriculture. Both tariffs are very important for both of those fields. What kind of things do you watch for when it comes to the impact of tariffs on Wisconsin?
Well, I mean, I think the first thing that even just this thing like, okay, tariffs are on. Okay, wait, the court said they're not going to be okay, but they're going to stay on. Like, there has been incredible uncertainty ever since April 1st, what Trump called Liberation Day, about what this tariff regime was going to look like. And uncertainty is just hard for business. It is hard for them to plan. It is hard for them to know what their markets are going to look like or what they're actually going to be doing. And to have this level of chaos and uncertainty is just a drag on itself. But again, and as you say, like all of this is, it's very hard to tell exactly what's going to settle out of this. But especially our exporters facing retaliatory tariffs is really like, what is that going to look like for the ag sector, the manufacturing sector? And honestly, one of the sectors we always pay a lot of attention to the manufacturing sector in Wisconsin because of its relative importance here, because it matters so much. And like the national manufacturing sector, and actually even a little worse, Wisconsin's manufacturing jobs are drifting down and not surging forward. So that certainly doesn't suggest that manufacturers see an exciting future market that they're getting ready for. Right now, we see the uncertainty and some retrenchment in the manufacturing sector.
You also mentioned immigration. Your report tackles that issue. A few hundred thousand migrant workers in the state's workforce. How do immigrant workers contribute to Wisconsin's economy?
I mean, there's 300,000 immigrants in Wisconsin. They make up 7% of the workforce. They generate $23 billion in economic output and contribute in every sector of our economy. 12% of our agricultural workforce, 16% of our doctors. So a kind of hostility overall to immigrants, I think, is a kind of misunderstanding or aligning those contributions. It also puts families, it makes families feel insecure, even families with strong, with the papers in place and the documented status, still either face the worry of, arbitrary arrest or just the worry of their community. And putting that level, again, this is like uncertainty and fear in a community. It puts consumers back. It keeps people, some folks say they're staying home. Our agriculture, our hospitality, and our food service industries, all which face labor shortages, are having a harder time filling jobs, all because of this hostility to immigrants at the federal level.
You and many other economists and others use U.S. federal government numbers. Now, earlier this summer, President Trump fired a Bureau of Labor Statistics staffer, saying he didn't like the numbers that the agency was reporting. What concerns do you have about the quality of data in the future if people are worried they're going to be fired if they give numbers that the president doesn't like to see?
Yeah, this is especially troubling in a sort of nerdy way, but I hope if your listeners will tolerate it. You know, when a leader, a president says, "Oh my gosh, this commissioner's the division that created this. I am firing this commissioner, and I am putting someone I want in this commissioner." When you've asked that agency, the Bureau of Labor Statistics, to be independent and indisputable, and to do the best science they can, and then you threaten or replace the top of the agency, it sends the signal that the only news that is, or the only data that is allowed to come out, is data that confirms the story you're trying to draw with your narrative. And I think the strength of the BLS, the federal architecture of data, has been that it is independent of the political process. We believe it, and then we look at it, and then we have to make our political arguments from there instead of undermining it. So when you replace the top of the agency, it just creates this kind of question, like, well, what is the quality of the data? The BLS infrastructure is massive. And I think, you know, it would take a lot to, you can't just, there's not a person who sits and can kind of like red mark and change the data, but it does undermine the kind of legitimacy and our mutual investment in that data to have a leader who is wanting, you know, some lab president who is wanting news that confirms his story rather than what the truth is. And I that's a real problem. And you know, going forward, we'll definitely be watching carefully what goes on at the BLS, what goes on with their methodology around saying how many jobs and what the level of unemployment is, because to change those things in order just to get different answers is not acceptable in terms of running an economy that's transparent and democratic.
Laura, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Thanks for having me. Great to be here.
That's Laura Dresser, Associate Director of the High Roads Strategy Center. She's co-author of the new report we've been talking about. It's called The State of Working Wisconsin 2025. Coming up, a Wisconsin neurologist turns to the arts as he cares for patients with multiple sclerosis, and he asks them,
"Have you done any artwork before?" And actually, often more than not, people would say, "Oh, yeah, I used to paint. I used to write poetry. I used to play an instrument, and I don't do it anymore."
Involving art in MS treatment, that's ahead on Wisconsin Today. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret. Multiple sclerosis is a neurological condition affecting nearly a million people in the U.S. There's no cure for MS. Treatments focus on slowing the progression of the disease. For one Wisconsin neurologist, the therapy plan for all of his patients includes making art, or rekindling artistic passions that were part of their lives before that MS diagnosis. Scientists have long known that the creative arts have therapeutic value. According to a study published last year in the journal Frontiers in Behavioral Neuroscience, things like dance, painting, and music appear to be effective in enhancing mental and physical health. Dr. Ahmed Obidat sees patients who are managing multiple sclerosis and immune disorders of the central nervous system. He's an associate professor of neurology at Fraidert and the Medical College of Wisconsin. Dr. Obidat spoke recently with Kate Archer Kent.
We know that early diagnosis and early treatment is really effective in managing an MS diagnosis. Can you talk about, first, some of the common symptoms of multiple sclerosis?
Certainly. So multiple sclerosis is a relatively common disease that affects mostly younger population. And it is a disease that can present in any way, actually, that has to do with the central nervous system. So when we think about what symptoms can happen in multiple sclerosis, these symptoms can include difficulties with vision, where some people may develop blurred vision or double vision. Some people will have weakness, maybe of an arm or a leg, or sometimes with an arm and a leg, and sometimes with a face too. Some people may have numbness or tingling, which is a symptom where people can feel pins and needles. Some people may have difficulty with controlling bladder. So unable to maybe empty their bladder completely, or they may have urgency, they have to go to the bathroom more often. And sometimes even it can be difficulties with controlling bowels. So the symptoms can be anything, but there are some other symptoms that we often forget about in multiple sclerosis, and we often don't talk much about, that include some of these cognitive difficulties. So people can have memory difficulties, attention difficulties, sometimes can have extreme fatigue that can interfere with day-to-day activity. Other symptoms may also include pain. And pain can be anywhere, and it can be severe and debilitating for people, that they can sometimes unable to do their day-to-day activity, or some people would lose their job because of these symptoms. So wide variety, and not every patient similar to the other. So it's a very, it's a disease of very unique characteristic. I often call it like snowflakes, right? Every snowflake is different. Mm-hmm. And this is what I think about multiple sclerosis, is everyone is unique with what they would experience with this disease.
In the midst of that uniqueness, though, you have to tell your patients that there isn't a cure right now for MS. How might that knowledge affect their mental health, their mental well-being?
Correct. Yeah, this is a very important point that you're raising here, is it remains a disease that we can treat, but we cannot cure. But we want to try to live well with MS. And we, as the healthcare team, we want to provide people living with this disease the best we can, from any treatment that we can provide or any support that we can provide, to help people live their life to the best possible.
And one of those interventions that you use in your practice is the creative arts, that art has a therapeutic value. Can you talk about that and how you are incorporating art into treatment plans?
Yes, this is a great, great question. And really, it is one of the things that's really dear to my heart. Because when you think about us as humans, we are creative. We are born creative. We are able to do a lot of things that we can produce. And sometimes we forget about it because we get busy in life, busy with doing a lot of things. And what we try to do in our practice is we try to talk to people living with multiple sclerosis and other neurological diseases. And we say, let's focus on abilities. Let's focus on how can we create art, and how can we incorporate this into day-to-day living? So I always would ask, do you create any art? Have you done any artwork before? And actually, often more than not, people would say, oh, yeah, I used to paint. I used to write poetry. I used to play an instrument, and I don't do it anymore. And then we talk about why we're not doing it anymore. They're like, oh, I cannot, because I can't use my fingers to play, for example, the guitar, or I cannot, my vision is not as good as used to be. I cannot paint and perceive colors as I used to. Then we say, well, let's get back to it. Let us help you get back to this. And I want you to try to get out this canvas, get out these colors, get out this guitar that has the dust on it, get it out and try to play it. And I want, next time I see you, I want you to tell me about this, and I want you to report back to me how did you feel when you do it. And more than not, many of the times people come in back and say, well, you know something? I can play the guitar again. I joined a band again, or I painted this, and I get my chart messages with paintings where people create and showing me the artwork that they created. But not only this, we had people who are known artists. So they actually are artists. They're professional artists who developed MS. And then MS really took away a lot of the abilities to move from them. So they had really severe symptoms. And what we did to actually return back to their art career is we helped them to be able to utilize art and employ art making as a rehab strategy. Creating art will help build new pathways, or even improve the connectivity in some areas where there are no damage that happened by the immune system. So there are ways where we could even see changes in brain networks that can help people gain back some of the abilities that maybe were trying MS was trying to take away from them.
I wonder, too, Dr. Obidot, whether the patients also realize that you're seeing them beyond their MS. You're seeing them in their artistic endeavors, that they are more than just their disease that they're trying to manage. Might that also be a piece of it, that you're taking their art and their creativity seriously?
Yeah, this is really another great point you're bringing here is I don't want to just treat MS. I want to get to know the person who's living with this disease, and I want to know them on various levels, because that's important, because when we take care of people living with chronic disease, and MS is considered a chronic lifelong disease, we build a long-term relationship with the person. And we, as their healthcare professional taking care of them, we get to know them, and we get to know them on various levels, and what they do in life, what their work, what their hobbies are, what they like to eat, what they don't like to eat, where do they go vacation, where they like to travel, or you know, do they like to garden or do something at home that we are very interested in learning about. So this is part of the healing process, is that we build this rapport and we build this relationship with patients for long term. And we highlight, you know, things around the arts or around the creativity, but around things that they love to do. So definitely this is, this helps. I think it helps really, and it's a powerful way of looking at, you know, practicing medicine.
We're talking about the intersection between medicine and art with Dr. Ahmed Obidot. He's a neurologist at Friedert and the Medical College of Wisconsin, who sees patients who are diagnosed with multiple sclerosis and includes art into a treatment intervention. Dr. Obidot, you know, art and art practice may not be something that everyone has access to. There's art supplies, there's instrument costs, transportation. You know, if you're going to see art, there's the cost of tickets. And then also there's that free time, the need to be able to spend time away from work or other things. How do you work with patients to make sure that they have the resources, that they have the time to participate in art in meaningful ways that could impact their life?
Yeah, this is a great question. Again, it's definitely, you know, art or creating art is something that may come at with a cost, a financial cost, or also time-related cost. And what we try to do is we try to first gauge interest from the patient and say, you know, is this something that you've done before? And if so, you know, do you have the tools to do it? Do you have canvas at home? Do you have colors? Do you have an instrument at home? And often, actually, the answer is yes, I do. Then we try to say, well, get those things out back again and try to utilize those things that you already have. If not, then we try actually to develop programs where we can have art making, I would say, workshops and classes and things like this, where we try to partner with nonprofit organizations to design certain art programs. As we move forward with things like this, I think we're going to be able to provide more access to people to be able to enjoy their creativity and be able to produce more and help them through the healing process. Now, for the time, you know, where to find the time, you know, there are always the weekends to do something in a weekend, right? Mm. Or to do something in the evening if we can, or early hours. And this is where probably we can incorporate some of these programs. When we developed our program that we submitted for funding, we actually intentionally had sessions that are during the week, and we did sessions that are during the weekend, because we want to make sure that people who are working during the week are able to still have access to such program. So we're hoping that with more submission of this type of program, that we will ultimately get some funds to be able to implement this in Wisconsin on a larger scale in the state as a whole, not only in Milwaukee.
A personal question here. Does art influence you personally as a physician and as a scientist? And if so, how?
Yes. So this is a great question too, again. And yes, it does. So I do incorporate art into my day-to-day, I would say, life. I am a photographer. I'm actually, in a way, I'm a professional photographer in a way, where I do exhibit at galleries, and I'm represented by Nadiana Art Gallery in Milwaukee. But I also do participate in exhibits all over the state and all over the country too, with photography. So I do a lot of nature photography. To me, that is healing for me too. You know, we as clinicians, as doctors, we need to take care of ourselves sometimes with certain ways. And for me, art is a way for me to heal also from, you know, just living my life and being there for people. And for me, a walk in nature with my camera is a healing. I think I can go hours and hours in a weekend and try to capture small moments in life and small things that we may just pass by and don't pay any attention to, but then it could be a work of art. So this is what I try to incorporate. I also write poetry, and that's another big part of what I like to do. And I've written poems on multiple sclerosis and on neurological, living with neurological disease and on taking care of people living with neurological disease. But that's part also of what I try to do. My wife is a professional artist. She's a painter, and she does 3D also work with sculpture. And that part also, you know, of having a spouse who is an artist, helps me also kind of, you know, continue to integrate this into our day-to-day life. You know, a dinner conversation over the arts is pretty nice and fun and keeps us engaged, and it is healing. You know, it's healing for everyone.
As you go through walks in nature, what is your most incredible picture you've taken in nature that you keep coming back to again and again? Is there one that you that stands out?
There are a number of them, but I think, you know, some of the small details in very little flowers. To me, the color, the design of the flowers, little ones in nature, when you do something called macro photography, where you actually taking a very close-up photo of these beautiful creatures. To me, those are the ones that I have the most connection with. How can we reflect on those structures, and how can we reflect on this beauty to incorporate this in our life and try to enjoy this so we can, you know, be strong and we can overcome a lot of these difficulties that we go through in life. So I would say this is really what mostly, you know, I love to look at and keep going back to these pictures, especially when I have these tiny flowers with water drops on them. And, to me, this combination, and with a light reflection, this combination just keeps attracting, you know, my eye, and I like to keep looking at it.
As we talk, it is absolutely apparent that you are convinced that art can really help heal, help in the healing process for people. You know, how might the scientific community do the research to better, measure the impact of art in the treatment process?
Yeah, this is very, very important question. And do we really need clinical trials to prove that art help people with neurological disease or help people in general? Probably not. But do we have to prove it? Maybe yes. Why is that? Because you mentioned earlier that there may be resources needed to support some of these activities. And maybe for organizations or payers to be able to recognize this as part of the healing process, they'll need data, right? You need data showing that this works. We all know that art makes people happy, art promotes healing, but we need to prove it through the scientific method.
Because you bill insurance for it.
Correct, yeah. Exactly. Or get, you know, people to pay for it, right?
Right.
So there have been works around this. And they are studies that looked at not only in people living with neurological disorders, but also people who are aging in life and older adults and even in children. But also there is a role for what we call the functional MRI. So functional MRI is a advanced type of imaging that not only look at the structure of the brain, but looks at the function of the brain as someone is engaged in creative activity. And what those studies have shown on various levels, that there is improved connectivity in certain brain areas and certain neuronal pathways and connections and not only improvement in this connectivity, but maybe even building new connectivity and new connections that we call the term synaptic plasticity or improvement of connection in specific areas. But, you know, I actually did a quick search on clinicaltrial.gov. It's a website where you find what active clinical studies are going on that looking at treatment or healing for diseases. And I searched how many active or recruiting or just recently completed clinical trials for multiple sclerosis in general. Mm-hmm. And they were over 3,500 studies. But guess what? Only five studies out of the over 3,500 studies, only five studies globally that is looking at something related to the art in the healing of people living with multiple sclerosis. Out of the 3,500 studies, only five studies, and only one of them in the United States that was actually terminated because of the COVID-19 pandemic. So definitely the connection between healing through the arts and multiple sclerosis is an area that is very much understudied and under-recognized, I would say, from a scientific method and from the scientific community.
Well, Dr. Obidat, I appreciate this conversation. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. Really, I enjoyed the conversation too. Thank you so much.
That's Dr. Ahmed Obidat, an associate professor of neurology at Froedtert and the Medical College of Wisconsin. He talked to Kate Archer Kent about how he incorporates the creative arts with his patients who are managing the symptoms of multiple sclerosis, a disease of the central nervous system. And for disclosure, Froedtert and the Medical College of Wisconsin are business sponsors of WPR. Coming up, Wisconsin and the Midwest may not be known for bagels, but hang on, says the explorer behind the Great Midwest Bagel Quest. Find out where to find them and what goes into a good bagel.
It needs to be chewy, but it can't veer into doughiness, and that's how I define a great bagel.
That's next on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret. Have you ever been on the hunt for the perfect cheese curd or traveled the state in search of the best burger or custard Wisconsin has to offer? Maybe you come from somewhere with amazing lobster rolls or ramen and you want to find the real deal here to remind you of home. One Wisconsin food fan is doing that with the New York City-style bagels of her childhood. She's documenting her journey on social media. It's called the Great Midwest Bagel Quest. Jen Rubin is a producer and storyteller based in Madison. She was the executive producer of Love, Wisconsin, and co-produced the Moth Story Slam in Madison. Now she's undertaking the Great Midwest Bagel Quest and researching a book about local bagel history for the Wisconsin Historical Society. Jen, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Yeah, I'm very excited to be here. Thanks.
Give us, please, the origin story of the Great Midwest Bagel Quest.
Yeah. First of all, I love the term origin story. It's like, so thank you for setting
like
it up that way.
It's like you're a comic book superhero.
Exactly. Yeah. I guess my origin story is that I grew up in New York. My family had a small business in Manhattan in like what I thought was like the food mecca in the 70s and 80s. So I ate bagels all the time, great bagels all the time. I was trying to think about this. It's possible I had a bagel like every single day in my school lunch from like kindergarten through high school. And then, of course, bagel spreads, which is like a Jewish thing for the holidays and with family. So I've been in Madison for 30 years. And when I first moved here, you know, I had a little bit of a panic of like, there's no good bagels here. My husband bought me a cookbook, Secrets of a Jewish Baker. So whenever I was like, oh my God, I need a bagel, I would just make my own. My mom died, I guess, a year and a half ago now, and she was like the last standing of that generation. And she comes from a very Yiddish culture, and she was sort of the culture bearer for our family. And in the weird thing that like your mind does in grief and sleep deprivation, I just sort of got it in my head like, I just want to have a good bagel. And then I was like, you know, there's got to be good bagels in the Midwest. I have not given the Midwest enough of a try for the bagels. So I just had this idea that I would just go on a search for bagels. Quest rhymed with Midwest. So And then, like, my family just got on board right away. My daughter made my logo. My niece made the banjo traveling ditty. And we were off. My friend Jenny Pressman, who born and raised in Queens but lives around the corner in Madison, we headed out to search for some bagels.
So as you're questing for great bagels, people who aren't connoisseurs might say, okay, what makes a good bagel?
Yeah, well, it's funny, you know, after I sort of self-appointed myself an expert, suddenly I realized, oh, I have to have a description. It can't be like, I sort of likened it, who was that Supreme Court Justice, Potter or something?
I don't know what pornography is, but I know when I see it.
So like I couldn't just be, yeah, I couldn't just be like, I know a good bagel when I taste it. I had to have some words for it. So I actually, I had my idea, but then I sort of ran it by a whole bunch of people to see how they described it. And it was close enough to mine. And so what I think a good bagel is it like it simply must have a crisp exterior. Like when you bite into it, it has to crackle, but it can't be like impossible. And then it has to have like a flavorful flavor. And then I kind of refer to it as like this ineffable quality where it needs to be chewy, but it can't veer into doughiness. And that's how I define a great bagel.
What I've heard from ice cream and custard connoisseurs, they say the benchmark is you test the vanilla at every place to test the quality. Bagels, are you testing the plain bagel or do you try different varieties when you're comparing one bagel to another?
So we have like a very exacting thing that we do. So I test sesame everywhere, only sesame. And then Jenny tests everything bagel because she just is like a zealot for those. And so so when we take them to the car and then we just bite into it unadulterated just to get the thing. And then I travel with cream cheese, cucumber, dill, salt, pepper, lox. So then we sort of make our own, assemble our own bagel after we've tasted the just sort of the quality of it. And then we do ask them if you have like a signature bagel, which we will taste. And some of the signature bagels are delicious, although it doesn't mean their baseline bagel is delicious. You know what I mean?
Before we start hitting the road and taking our tour of bagels, you've also looked some into Wisconsin bagel history. And I think a lot of people would think the history of Wisconsin bagels is there isn't a history of Wisconsin bagels. Well, you found some evidence. What kind of things did you discover?
Yeah, I found a lot. And I will say, so bagels came to the U.S. probably like 1900. It was Jewish Polish bakers. And then while obviously most Jewish people in the U.S. stayed in New York City, they also did not stay in New York City. So wherever there was a Jewish enclave, there's bagels, there's bagel shops, there's bagel baker unions. So Detroit, Milwaukee, Chicago, St. Louis. So in all of those cities, there's like super interesting history. Milwaukee, yeah, they had just a lot of Jewish bakeries where they made their own bagels. There was a union that I think went on strike. I think it was like in 1941, and there was a Milwaukee... Was it the Journal Sentinel in 1941?
Probably just there was the Journal and the Sentinel, two separate papers. Okay. I don't know which was around in 41.
Yeah,
then.
Well, one of them, like, you know, sort of bemoaned the bagel shortage. So bagels have been around where there were Jewish enclaves. Bagels have been around.
You found a bagel maker, I understand, in Marinette, Diana Siegel. Can you share her story?
Yeah, so she was, so the Wisconsin Historical Society, which is just like a treasure trove, like there's so much in there. And so there was these oral archives of Jewish people in Wisconsin. I think these oral archives were recorded like in the 1950s. And so her mother came from Lithuania, I think maybe it was like 1905 or 1910, and settled in Marinette and taught Diana how to make bagels. And in the interview, she said her mother learned, like I think it said her mother learned in like the forests of Lithuania. What I've since learned, I think what that just means is it was outdoors, because when you bake bagels, you're at like 500 degrees. It's super hot. You're boiling water. So, if you could bake in an outdoor oven, you were doing that. So that's probably what it means. I don't know. But so, yeah, so she was making bagels in her home probably as early as 1920s, I guess.
Now, you've made bagels. You make them. You were just telling me before we started, you maybe have some bagel making coming up. Talk us through the process for those of us who've never made a bagel.
Yeah, definitely. So I think of a bagel a little bit as a fragile flower, right? There's like these things that need to happen. There's very little ingredients. You wouldn't think it'd be that complicated for something that just has water, yeast, flour, salt, a little bit of oil, a little bit of barley malt. But partly what you need to do is it's like super dense dough. So if anyone's ever baked dough, and I make challah, my husband he's like a fourth generation sourdough maker. When you need bagels, like, you have to set a timer so you stay on task, because you're going to want to give up. It's like at least 20 minutes. You just have to knead it. It's really heavy dough. And then after you shape them, like the magic in it is you have to like cold ferment it for at least 24 hours. So you put it in the refrigerator. That's where you get the flavorful flavor. There's science involved that I can never describe science, but there's things with microbes and whatnot. Then after you let the flavor like develop, then you boil it for a minute. Which, if you don't boil a bagel, you don't get the crackly exterior. In my mind, I won't eat it. Like, then I'll just have some other bread. There's better bread. Then you bake it at 500 degrees. Well, you put whatever you want on it, then you bake it.
We are on the Great Midwest Bagel Quest. Jen Rubin is with us to share her discoveries. Let's hit the road now. Jen, where have you gone in search of good bagels around Wisconsin and elsewhere in the Midwest?
Well, so the places I went to, like, officially on the quest, and I say officially, like, officially to me, you know, is Chicago, Milwaukee, Detroit, Ann Arbor, the Twin Cities, Madison, St. Louis. But I will say, so I used to produce Love Wisconsin, which is a statewide storytelling project for Wisconsin Humanities, and so I go to lots of parts of Wisconsin. So for the year and a half that my job overlapped with this, you know, quest, anywhere I go, I check out the bagel. So I tried bagels in Sheboygan, I've tried bagels in Ashland, and La Crosse, and Appleton also, although those were not. So, like, my criteria of where I went officially for bagels, like, you have to make a list. You have to be on a best of list, or people recommended it. And so none of those made a best of list or were recommended. But since I was there, I tried them.
Let's name some names. Where did you manage to find good bagels? Let's stay in Wisconsin here. What are some of the best bagels you've had in Wisconsin?
Well, okay. So my favorite place probably is Ruby's Bagels in Milwaukee. Partly, you know, I love a good story. And she actually made this Bon Appetit list of, yes, you can find great bagels outside New York or something. And she was a Latina-owned food cart pop-up bagel maker, you know, which I just sort of loved all of that. But it does come to this thing I've discovered about bagels, at least in the Midwest, but probably everywhere right now, which is, if it wasn't for this, like, younger sort of millennial back-to-the-craft artisanal bagel makers, like, coming back to this artisanal skill, there'd be almost no bagel shops. And so she is one of those. So she now has a brick and mortar. When I tried her bagels, she was at a pop-up. Like I said, a bagel's a fragile flower. And so after like the first couple hours, it's like not at its best unless you toast it. And so hers was a delicious flavor, but it like needed to be toasted to be its best self.
And how about some that maybe aren't on the official Great Midwest list, but when you were out and about for Love Wisconsin and you stumbled across a good bagel place in a place you might not have expected to?
So I was in Ashland doing a Great Lakes storytelling workshop with, I think it was like the UW Water Library. And I just happened to be walking down the one main street in Ashland and saw a bakery, and I love a bakery. And I walked in, I saw they had bagels. And I actually don't even remember the name of this place, but the bagels were quite good. But I think my favorite story is I happened to be going with a friend to La Crosse. Her family's from La Crosse, and I like hanging out in La Crosse. So we were going there, and a friend, an acquaintance, happened to email me about something. And I'm like, I'm on the road to La Crosse. I'll get back to you. He's like, you're on the road to La Crosse. A friend of mine makes bagels in La Crosse. I'm going to hook you up. So this guy, his name is Kevin. He started during the pandemic making bagels. And I think this was right after Russia invaded Ukraine. So he decided to use like traditional Ukrainian bread recipes. So he met me at a coffee shop. He probably brought me 25
wow.
bagels, like four different flavor varieties. And I said it in ahead of time, like, I am judging from the New York traditional standard. It's possible I'm going to be, you know, a little more of a, like a harder about it, you know, just warn you. And so I actually found them just delicious, but did not have the crackly exterior, okay. but they were delicious. And I just loved hearing his whole history of how he learned how to bake and why he wanted to support what he was supporting. Mm.
You started off talking about growing up with bagels as part of your family heritage. Can you talk about that some more? What bagels, how you feel they connect you maybe with your mom and other family, going back as far as you want?
Yeah, well, I will say, you know, I feel like, you know, every culture, every ethnicity has like the food, right? Mm-hmm. And so, and that's actually been a fun part of this quest is like people, I'm learning, you know, how people feel about their mac and cheese or how they feel about their kimchi or whatever it is. But so for me, actually, you know, my mom's chicken soup and my grandma's challah are sort of the thing that's in my, you know, deep in my heart. But bagels was just like everyday life, I think, for Jewish people, at least in New York when I was growing up. I've learned on this, like, it's true for people in Detroit, true for people in Chicago. And so, yeah, like, I don't know if you've ever been to, like, a no-holds bar bagel spread, right, where you just have, you know, you have the whitefish, you have the lox, mm-hmm. you have the, you know, the scallion cream cheese, you know, you just have, the, you know, the red onions, the works. And so, and the thing about a bagel, if it's a good bagel, like, if you bite into a bagel, you have to put all your attention to chewing it, right? Like, so you know, so you have to pause in conversation, you know, so it's like, so it's just like, I don't know. Just for me, it's just, it sort of reminds me of home and my childhood. And it's what I've tried to bring here. I actually started a bagel club. I learned about a bagel club in the Twin Cities in the 70s. So now I have a bagel club. So, yeah.
Now, bagels are one of those foods that clearly started off with associated with a particular ethnic group in the United States, and it made the leap, right? I mean, there were, I would stack store-bought bagels like cordwood in their packages from the freezer in my arm because my kids would have lived on bagels for like 3 years
right.
if I'd let them.
Right.
How do you feel about that, this food you associate with heritage and family, and yet it's also got a very broad mainstream interest as well?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think, you know, the bagel sort of mass production story is I think, just a story of mass production mm-hmm. of food in this country, right? And so I think it was actually one of the last bread industries to fall because the dough would break all of the machines. but this guy, Mickey Thompson, created a bagel-making machine, I think, in the late 50s, partnered with Lenders, and it took off from there. And so Lenders, Murray Lenders, referred to it like his goal was the bagelization of America.
Where is the Great Midwest Bagel Quest going to take you next?
Well, I think I do want to go back to Detroit because a couple new things happened in Detroit. I want to try a bagel. But I do think, so on this quest with Jenny Pressman, we've tasted and loved a lot of bagels. I have broken my New York. I no longer am New York centric with my bagel.
Wow.
I actually feel like my little side tagline is I'm telling the untold story of the Midwest bagel because there actually are bagel historians and I feel like they have done a little flyover with Midwestern bagel history. So anyway, but that said, she and I have never tasted New York bagels together. And so we're both going to be in New York coincidentally at the same time in October. So we are going to sort of end the official leg of the tour tasting New York bagels and seeing how we think it compares to the Midwest bagels.
Jen, thanks so much for sharing this with us today.
Great. Thanks for having me. It was fun.
That was Jen Rubin, a writer, producer, and bagel aficionado based in Madison. She joined us to talk about her latest project, The Great Midwest Bagel Quest. It's taken her around the state and beyond in search of tasty bagels and deeper connections with her Jewish heritage. There you have it, the Great Midwest Bagel Quest. How about you? Are you a bagel fan? Did you grow up with bagels or discover them later in life? What are your favorites? Where do you get them? And how do you serve them up? Toasted or no? Cream cheese? Flavored cream cheese? Sandwich? Lox? Tell us about it. Email wisconsintoday@wpr.org. That's wisconsintoday@wpr.org. Or you can call 888-642-0232. Leave a message there or text 888-642-0232. Wisconsin Today producers include Royce Podeswa, Avery Lee Rogers, and Rochelle Wilson. Our technical directors are Tyler Ditter and Sarah Hopeful. Learn more about us at wpr.org/wisconsintoday. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to WPR News.